Hey, welcome back for another edition of Old School Guns. I believe this is actually episode 23, which is pretty good. I never thought it would go on this long. We've picked up some new listeners and new subscribers, so excellent. If you like what you hear, remember, hit the subscribe button or hit the like button, the follower button, whatever they call it on the platform you use. And you'll get a notification as to when the next episode posts. And as always, we are unencumbered. We are not owned by anybody. So nobody calls me up and tells me what to say, what to do, what to run down. I'm owned by no advertisers. Never have been, never will be. So if I say something is a good product, it's because I know it's a good product. And if I say something's lousy, it's because it's lousy and I'm not being told by someone else to run down a product for a competitor's sake. So hey, let's get into it. Got some interesting news. In California, they're charging a man who had a hoard of over 1,000 guns. And this is probably a sad story. It looks like it's kind of an older man who had 1,000 guns in his house. And that's not a crime. You can own 1,000 guns. Unfortunately, in California, they're busting him on what appears to be the following. Assault rifles that he's not supposed to have there. And that's not selective fire rifles. They call them assault rifles. But they're actually semi-automatic rifles he's not allowed to have there. One can only assume that they're probably some AR-style rifles and maybe a few others. And in California law, it can also be any semi-automatic that's got banned features, you know, like some evil flash hider or a detachable magazine, some nonsense like that. You know, a detachable magazine and a pistol grip. So they got him on that. They also are charging him for transferring handguns without going through a dealer. So I don't know how they determined that. I assume they researched the gun, figured out who the owner was, and then the original owner said, yeah, I sold it to this guy, and they did not process it through a dealer. So that's probably how they discovered that. And the third thing was seven short-barreled rifles, which, you know, I don't know if those are what the extent of those is. They might be technical violations. You have something with a 14.5-inch barrel, and it's supposed to have a permanently attached muzzle device on it to bring it over 16 inches. And if that device is not attached in the appropriate manner, you know, if it's not welded to their specifications or soldered to their specifications, then it's considered that it's not there, and therefore you have a 14.5-inch barrel and thus a short-barreled rifle. So I don't know if it's technical violations like that or if it's something like an AR lower with a 7.5-inch upper, which is, you know, clearly there's no mistake about that, whatever that is. The shame of it is, there's two aspects to this. First of all, when I looked, the man had a Hispanic name. So I'm surprised nobody's screaming racism, because if this had been any other crime, this would be some sort of a racist deal, because that's the first thing people yell anymore at anything. The next thing is that all those guns would be legal in real states. In free states, if you live in free America, and we can now just kind of, you know, look at the gun laws and color what is free America and what is not. For instance, if he lived in Kansas and had done the proper paperwork for the short-barreled rifles, everything he had would be legal, according to the report. Having not examined them or seen any kind of detailed information. But from what they've released, everything he has would have been legal. So this is where gun laws run amok. This is an example where an individual, he probably, most of that stuff, almost everything he owned would have been legal in California 30 years ago, but they've gradually criminalized gun ownership. Now, the other aspect of this is, it's clearly an old man who has kind of a hoarding problem, and, you know, if he had been hoarding, you know, cans of tuna fish or cases of MREs or something else. It's never even would have made the news. It's part of the drumbeat that the national media is trying to get started against guns. They're trying to get it started. Because nobody, this old man obviously wasn't going to go out and arm 1,000 people with these things. He was keeping them. They were in his house and probably were discovered through some sort of interventionist type deal. Somebody saw them in there and reported them. You know, could have been anybody from a repairman to a social worker to anything else, probably reported them. And, you know, that's the BS of all this. You know, we're living in a place now where, you know, and part of this has been, you know, if you see something, say something. And that's this, you know, rat them out to the state. That's part of all this. And so, you know, but the truth of the matter is, if you want to own a lot of guns, he should have sold his house and moved to Nevada. And everything he had could have been legal. Like I said, he would have had to do some paperwork for short-barreled rifles. But everything would have been legal, and this wouldn't even have been a story. And there may be people in Nevada who have just as much as he does, and they've gone about it correctly, and they're never going to be in the news, no matter who reports them, because there is no crime there. But beware, there's a national drumbeat where they're trying to bring this up. Another quick case was after the people of Virginia convinced their representatives not to do any of this gun control stuff that Governor Blackface and his little buddy, the sexual assaulter, that those two were trying to cover their tracks with, you know, deflect from their own problems and their own issues. Well, you know, 2 days after that, they go, yeah, pregnant woman was shot only, you know, 12 blocks away from where they held this session. And that is an unfortunate, tragic thing, but the two are not related. The two are not related at all. And there's no, from the case, there's no empirical proof that any gun control law would have helped this lady not get shot. You know, that's just the way it is. And so they can't blame every single thing that happens with a firearm on the fact that there are not all these onerous laws. And they can't draw this. It's a false conclusion to draw that if we'd had more gun control laws, this lady would have been fine. There's no correlation there. So absolutely, you know, there is attempting to be a drumbeat, but we have to resist it. We have to resist it with facts. Now is the time to get involved. Now is the time to speak up to your legislators. 2020 is going to be just around the bend. It's just around the bend. You know, we already see the presidential race kind of starting up. And, you know, the best defense of the Second Amendment starts in your local districts with grassroots people because, you know, all politicians know that votes matter. Well, we have the squad. And that is Ocasio-Cortez, Omar, Presley, and Tlaib. It's hard to remember. It's hard to put all that. My mind can't fit that much stupidity into one sentence. So, you know, those four, they're getting the education of their lives, and it's costing them. First of all, you don't, in Washington, just the way the swamp works, you don't mess with the higher-ups of your own party. And believe me, there have to be plans underway for Pelosi to get even with these people. They have embarrassed her, they've undercut her, everything else. She is going to get even with them. Don't think for a moment they're going to get away with this. They are not going to get away with this. So that's it. The other side of the coin is the bully pulpit of the president. They've just gotten pulverized, and he basically can continue to do so. He's been pulverizing them justifiably because Ocasio-Cortez lied about what she saw at the border. Omar sympathizes with terrorists and all kinds of other very bad people. And just think back to the Somalia operation, you know, that George H.W. Bush fiasco where we send first we try to send them food, and then all the bad people are stealing food. Then we send them troops to protect the food and try to distribute it, but the bad people are still out there. The bad actors are still out there. So then we start taking out the bad people, and then all of a sudden we wind up in the big gunfight in Mogadishu. We lose 20 guys, and there are hundreds of Somalis who were acting like animals, but there are hundreds of Somalis got mowed down. And that all started from, let's give them some food because they're starving. So, you know, she's sympathizing with all the bad people in all this. And she doesn't like U.S. troops. She doesn't like any of that. And this person has weaseled her way into Congress. And she needs to be not sent back, but voted out. She needs, you know, instead of send her back, they should chant, vote her out. And if you can't vote her out, then you got to isolate her. Vote enough of these wackos out of the Congress so that she's so isolated she becomes like Sheila Jackson Lee, some crazy old woman, you know, out there ranting and raving. So that's kind of the deal on the squad. They've you know, Ocasio-Cortez lied about what she saw on the border. You know, there's been congressional testimony that is not refuted. There's other people have done investigations down there. What she said was clearly a lie. I mean, it's not true. It's simply not true. And, you know, she's getting pulverized for it. People know she's a liar. At some point, they'll figure out, you know, she's a dumb young girl who shouldn't be in Congress. You know, she should still be a barista because that is evidently more of her calling. But I'm surprised she's not part of this Area 51. Let's go storm Area 51, because as I've said before, she does look like she's just seen a UFO or something, that wild-eyed look that she always seems to have. So anyway, maybe she, you know, maybe there's a future for her in the UFO investigation thing. I think that would be a better use of her time. Now, that brings up a related thing. This whole Facebook thing. There are a lot of, quote, closed groups on Facebook, which the media is now calling secret groups. Well, they're not secret. The people who know about them are in it. Anyone can apply to join them. Whether they accept you or not is different, you know. But there are a lot of, like, you know, everything from World War II airplane groups to this kind of group to World War I history groups to, you know, all kinds of things, different car groups, fashion groups, there's all these kind of groups. And they close it so that essentially trolls can't get in there. And they also, you know, it's kind of a closed community, kind of want to keep it among themselves. Not a secret group. This isn't Skull and Bones. This isn't, you know, some sort of secret society. These are groups which keep a selected, you know, they have selected membership, usually people from the same kind of community. Well, evidently, Facebook is willing to turn all that over. And if somebody gets in there and says, oh, they're doing offensive social media posts, then all of a sudden now it gets investigated. You know, word to the wise is be very, very careful. It's easy to get caught up in an argument on Facebook. It's easy to say some things on Facebook that you would say in public and nobody would even question, but on Facebook they're written and they can be interpreted a myriad of different ways. So I would be very, very careful about what you post, what group you belong to, especially if you work for the government. Apparently they all, but private companies are doing it too, so maybe that's not that critical, because private companies are doing it too. They don't like what you post on Facebook, they fire you. You know, even though it's none of their business and may not even be related to them. They go like, well, you work for us. They make this nexus that, well, if they know you posted this and somebody figures out you work for us, this thing you posted reflects on us and therefore we fire you. You know, this is Soviet. This is how the Soviet Union works. This is how the Soviet Union basically kiboshed free speech. And, you know, they're not sending you to the gulag, but if they economically damage you, people will shut up. And they know it. They can intimidate anyone into shutting up because they will economically damage you. And, you know, being economically damaged in our society, you may as well be in a gulag because, you know, this, we live in a capitalist society where you need money to buy things, even just the necessities of life. And I don't think it'd be very much fun to have to explain to your family, well, I posted some stuff on Facebook and now I got fired and now I'm on unemployment and you can't do this, you can't have that, we're, you know, we're going to lose our home, we're going to lose all this stuff. You know, that's where this is coming to. They don't like what you say, your job, and the dominoes will fall, the job, the house, the car, all this stuff will fall. So it's a very, very intimidating situation. So be careful. You know, I'm on Facebook. I should get off it. I should probably just do it. The only reason I don't is because I do keep track of a few old friends and some relatives on it. And maybe, though, just no politics on Facebook is a good idea. Just days after he says, hey, Great Britain won't help the United States in any war with Iran. Well, guess what? Two of your ships are now guests of the Iranian government, along with their crews and their cargo and all this. Great Britain, once the master of the seas, Great Britain used to keep the sea lanes open. You know, it was Great Britain which essentially enforced the Monroe Doctrine during a large part of the 1800s. Great Britain, which used to be, you know, king of the seas, now what are you going to do? Are you going to knuckle under to the Iranians, or are you going to think about it? And trust me, there is going to be no big land war with Iran. There just is not. What's going to happen is we'll pulverize their navy, and we'll pulverize their air force, and they won't be able to do anything in the Arabian Sea or the Persian Gulf or the Straits of Hormuz, except look at it. We'll just make sure. And we're already reoccupying a couple of air bases in Saudi Arabia. You know, I mean, as much as I love the F-4 Phantom as a fighter, it's 1950s technology. That's really all the Iranians have left. And, you know, we don't even use them for target drones anymore. You know, we used to use F-4s for target drones. We don't even do that anymore. So, you know, you're taking something that's easier to hit than a target drone, and that's what the Iranians are flying. So they're not going to get very far. Their air force is going to get shot down. Their navy is going to get blown out of the water, and they're not going to be able to do diddly about it. And then we can start leveraging them and say, give up the nukes. And, you know, eventually someday there'll be a revolution there. And I hope they wake up and do it soon. But, yeah, Boris Johnson should never make these kind of pronouncements unless he's really thought them through and realizes that anything like that you say can be overcome by just a simple twist of history like they have been with this. Oh, one other thing I saw in the news. The new Corvette C8 is coming out. And if you know Corvettes, they, from the first model, was called the C1, and then they went through the C2, which was the really cool looking Stingray, the C3, which was the shark one, the C4, which kind of looked like an 80s, big boxy 80s Ferrari, then the C5, C6, C7 were the ones you kind of see on the road a lot today. But the C8 is going to become a mid-engine supercar, and it's kind of a shame, really, because the Corvette was always kind of an American, everyman sports car. And they originally started out with the very first models, kind of being like the, you know, the moderately priced European cars, sports cars that were fun to drive. They weren't muscle cars. They weren't designed just to go in a straight line, super fast, and have all the, and to compete with pony cars and you know, GTOs, Mustangs, and Camaros, and all that. They were always designed and supposed to be a great road car that would handle as well as being fast. But now, even now, the C7 Corvettes are, to buy them new, they're fantastically expensive. You know, approaching, I think they're anywhere from $60,000 to $90,000, depending on the options and all the things you get. secondhand, a lot of the earlier Corvettes are much more affordable. But they were always kind of a fun car that if you always admired a Corvette, that someday you could own one. Maybe a secondhand one, but you could always own one. But once they become a supercar, that's not going to happen. And right now, they're like the Ford GT. Obviously, the price is going to go way up. So, the Corvette will kind of come out of the hands of the everyday American. That's a sad thing. That's kind of a turn of history. It's really what it comes down to is they've actually quit making it. And they now have introduced a new supercar. They gave it the same name, but it's not hitting the same market. So the car they were making for the everyman, something that if you sacrificed for, you could at least afford it, that's gone now. It's gone. And it's a shame. It's a real shame. Okay. If you've been looking, let's do some media critiques here, gun media. InRange finally figured out the difference between API and AP ammo. You remember they did a test comparison of Soviet API and US AP ammo. And essentially, that what they and they've taken that video down and they've corrected it because through some reviews and through some suggestions, they've come to the realization that API has a different, it's a different type of round. It has supposed to have a different effect on target than just penetration. And so with API, you don't design it to penetrate as much armor as you can. You design it to penetrate some armor and flash and catch fuel or something else that's flammable on fire. So they kind of saw that, and they're good guys. They corrected it. I think part of it is, part of the problem is these are not professional military guys, and they don't have the background. To most military guys, we know the difference between AP and API, and that they're supposed to do something completely different. And this is part of the reason of, you got to really research your topic or talk to people who have the experience. And but it's good that they corrected it, and it's good they admitted their mistake. I thought they were pretty big to do that, and I thought they put up a good video. And it's a very interesting video because it does show the effects, the penetrating 3/8 inch armor plate and what those rounds will do. So I thought that was really pretty good that they did that. But yeah, I saw the original one and just kind of threw it in my hands. But oh well, they've made it better, and they have now learned it, and it probably is somewhat humbling lesson, but they've learned it. The other thing that I thought was interesting was the InRange July Q&A was much better than the earlier one. They didn't have the three, the two drunken guys on there, and so they brought back the Forgotten Weapons. Ian is back, and the interesting part was, if you remember, if you've listened to enough of the podcasts, you know that we talked about what the future infantry rifle might look like. Nobody really knows because it's all subjective, and nobody can really say what it will be. And it may be something we don't even conceive of right now. It may be an obvious idea that we just simply haven't thought of. But what they were talking about was, well, what's the next big advancement going to be? And they were thinking a centralized battery system to power all the accessories that people are putting on. So you wouldn't need separate batteries for an optic, a laser, a range finder. Those are the three things I can think of right away. And if you remember, we talked about it, essentially a centralized power bank to power things, not only those types of things, but also to run the mechanism. Right now, if you look, if you take their theory and say, why have a separate bag of batteries for everything? Well, that's what your magazine is, because the power that operates your firearm is in the primer and the powder charge. And anybody who's shot surplus ammo has undoubtedly over the years gotten a hold of some that are duds. And hey, you chamber it, you aim, you pull the trigger, and you hear this sickening click, and nothing happens. That's because your rifle is essentially, I don't want to say battery powered, but it needs a little energy packet, which is the powder and the primer, to make it work, at least to get the bullet out. Now, semi-automatics, it also reloads the chamber and gets it and cocks the internal hammer and gets it to fire again. So, you know, we do have every round is a little battery, and if one of those little batteries fails because it, you know, somehow it has been contaminated or for whatever reason, then you got to kick it out and do some immediate action, get it in. There'll be a time when I think there'll be an electromagnetic bolts, and it cycles just the same way that a minigun, you know, they don't use the recoil of the round to operate the mechanism. They use an electric motor, and it spins it around. And really, the powder is there just to push the bullet out of the barrel. The mechanism is going to work no matter what. And, you know, someday rifles may get to that same place, and they'll be powered by a central battery pack, or I should say energy storage, that'll be in the buttstock of the weapon as we envision it now. And maybe there's the optic is, you know, there's some sort of solar gathering thing on the outside of the rifle. Maybe it's on the handguards, maybe it's on top of the optic, the way the HoloSun is now. Maybe there's also a battery, a backup battery or energy pack that's in the magazine. So you plug it in and it transfers some energy so that you can go. And the arms room's rack that you store the weapon in will have like a trickle charge that goes up into the weapon, so it's always 100% ready to go. That would make the reason they're probably not going after that, and they kind of theorized, you know, and we're kind of talking about that a little bit. I would say one reason is there's two paradigms to look at. The one paradigm is the Korean War, and the other is the War on Terror. In the Korean War, you could get stuck out there for a long ways, and you could be isolated and fighting the communists, and supply didn't really catch up to you. In World War II, especially the latter part of the war, I'm not taking the Philippines, which were cut off, and a few things out, we basically had a push system of logistics. So if you hit the beaches at Normandy, there was this wave of supplies that came up behind you, and they were pushing that stuff forward. And unless you were cut off like at Bastogne or something during the Battle of the Bulge, getting resupplied wasn't a problem. So the Korean War was a bit more problematic. The supply system, we put troops over there, and the supply system had to hustle to catch up. So there were a lot of engagements where stuff was running short. Now, if you have, instead of an M1 in Korea in 1950, if you have an M4 with all the doodads on it, maybe part of what doesn't catch up to you is the batteries and all that, in which case the electric-powered rifle is a better idea, you know, which is something where I'm not going to have all my accessories go down because I can't get these batteries over and over again. I'm going to have a way to continually charge this weapon, even if it's just the power of the sun, or I have magazines with a little battery pack in it. It'll keep this thing going for days and weeks. Then you look at the War on Terror. The War on Terror is really a lot of, you know, quick operations, a lot of raids, a lot of things where you go out and you do an operation and you're back 4 hours later, maybe, or you're back 6 hours later, or you're back 24 hours later. A lot of these types of things, or you have a base that you operate out of, so you have the ability to keep things going, in which case the batteries and all that are not a problem. Therefore, the impetus to make a centralized power system for your rifle to power all this stuff really isn't as urgent as it would be in a Korean War type of scenario. So I know that may not be real clear, but the real upshot of it is the duration depends on the duration you're going to be out and potentially without support is going to generate whether or not the carrying the batteries and resupplying the batteries is a problem or not. And if it becomes a problem, they may look for definitely a centralized or longer duration solution to provide power. And when that happens, maybe the batteries that are in these things just become backups, or maybe the designs become smaller, more compact, lighter weight. You know, we'll see. But it was interesting they talked about that, something that we had talked about in a previous podcast, a little bit differently, but the same idea. Okay, let us get to the best part of the podcast, which is question and answers. And so I got one question. This came from someone at work who said, hey, you mentioned the expense of some magazines like the 351. Our old friend that we keep coming back to, 351 Winchester, came back to it in hand loading and a few other things. What are the most expensive firearms magazines, and should you avoid those kind of firearms because of that? Very interesting question. I would say that there's two parts of that that I kind of zero in on. One is, if you have a 350, we'll talk about our friend the 351. If you have a 351 Winchester rifle, you definitely are, spare magazines are going to be expensive. The 5-round standard magazine that it came from the factory with is about $100 on the used magazine market. Okay, just that's what they cost. And they haven't made them new for, well, 1957 was the last year they allegedly made the rifles, although I think they were just assembling them from parts they already had. But so, you know, they haven't made them since the 1950s, so you're talking over 60 years. So you can find them on the, you know, eBay or gun broker. They're going to cost about $100. That's a 5-round magazine. Doesn't look particularly high speed. It's very, very streamlined, though, and fits the gun. And if you're just going to do casual shooting, they're fine. If you get the vintage, and I'm saying vintage as opposed to modern, the vintage 10-rounders are up there. They will run you from $200 to $250, just depending on the deal you're able to get. Sometimes people want them, sometimes they don't. During the AMC's of the Sun, the Pierce Brosnan, it's not really a Western, it's kind of a, you know, takes place pre-First World War, 1914, 1915, right in there, 1916, before the U.S. involvement in the First World War. When that was on, and they were using 351 Winchesters with the 10-round vintage magazines, hey, the prices were up. I've noticed the prices seem to have come down a little bit now, but it's still going to be about $200 to get one of those. So that's what they cost. The Triple K magazines they make for these things, which for the most part they work. You might have to tweak them a little bit. There's some YouTube videos on how to tweak them. If you can find them new, they're about $50 for the 10-rounder. I haven't found any new for a while. Haven't really looked that hard either. But and on the same gun broker type places and eBay, you get them about $70, and it's not much. You're not getting much for your money because they are not anywhere near the quality of the vintage magazines. But they can be made to work, and they don't look too bad. They don't look great, but they don't look too bad. So the short story of this is, if somebody offers you a great deal on a Winchester 351 rifle, and it does not have a magazine, well, now you know what a decent magazine to put in it, what a magazine will cost. The crummy looking aftermarket ones, which are kind of a black, just kind of a black finish. I don't think they're painted. I think they're more of just a black oxide type finish. All the way up to the vintage. And I don't think they were made by Winchester. That's why I'm calling them vintage. A lot of people call them factory 10-rounders, but I don't think they were actually made by Winchester. Although they may have been. They may have been sold by Winchester, but I don't know if they made them. And so look at some pictures of each kind and know what you're buying. And there you go. That's probably the most expensive magazine. Now, one of the hardest ones to get, and I just ran into this, is the original CZ-75 takes a different magazine than some of the later iterations of the guns. And, you know, I don't know why they changed it. I don't know how they thought that was optimizing anything. The last I saw original CZ-75 magazines, which will work in the original guns, were $40 a piece, which is pretty steep for an auto pistol mag. The ones for the CZ-85s, and I think even the CZ, I think they made a CZ-75B. Those don't work. They don't fit. No fit. So they don't fit. So you just have to find the originals when you can, and you may buy them, find out they don't fit, then, you know, then that becomes another shaggy dog story of returning it and all that. So those are the two that I can think of right away. And I'm taking out, you know, obviously they're experimental guns, or there's kind of very limited foreign guns. You know, the SVT 3840 magazine is hard to get. The Rashid magazine, the Egyptian Rashid magazine, is almost impossible to get. Because they issued the rifle, but it was really designed not to have interchangeable magazines. It was designed to have, you know, to be loaded with the what we call stripper clips, the magazine charger type clips. So, you know, the fact that it was detachable, it wasn't like you carried a pouch with a bunch of them in there. So they never made a bunch of them, so there's not a bunch of them around. Okay, what is your favorite vintage 9mm pistol for shooting? And I'm glad the question contained for shooting, because you could always say, well, what's my favorite? Is a Luger more favorite than a Browning High Power? You know, favorite is very subjective, but as far as having the favorite pistol, but which one do I, vintage 9mm, do I think is the best shooter? And this is like, you know, kind of, I don't want to say World War II and backwards, but it's basically kind of World War II and backwards. I would have to say that the two best shooting are the Walther P38 is a great shooter. And I'm talking the steel frame ones. The aluminum frame ones just don't feel as good to me. The steel frame ones will feel very good. Between that and the either Finnish or Swedish version of the Leite, you know, the L35, or I think the Swedes call theirs the M40. And they are the best. They shoot great. And the nice part about the M40 is that it's got a fixed barrel. It's kind of like the Luger. It has a very Luger look to it as far as the grip angle, and it's, you know, you wouldn't mistake the two, but you could look at it and say, yeah, this is definitely kind of at least inspired by the form of the Luger. So that's a fun pistol, a very accurate pistol to shoot because it's got a fixed barrel. P38 is really good also. It's a fun pistol to shoot. It really is. Really nice pistol. So I'd have to say toss up between those two. Toss up between those two. If you're going to carry it around all day, the P38's a little less weighty because it's a little less chunky. But yeah, they're both really good. I enjoy shooting them. P38 parts you can still get. The World War II parts are probably scarce, but as far as lady parts, I don't know. I haven't broken anything on it because I really don't shoot them all that much. So, all right, here's one. You mentioned the SVT 3840, SVT 40, really. Would have been a great rifle for the UK. Why not just give them M1s, which was a better rifle? Yeah, when I was talking about that, I was thinking that had they developed it in the 1930s, before the war, after the war starts, all bets are off. Guess what? You're going to have Lee Enfields, and they, you know, the British, I give them credit. They produced SCADs, Lee Enfields, and they were smart enough. In between the war, they basically figured out how to simplify production, and you know, they turned out a really good rifle without sacrificing really any of the good qualities that made the Lee Enfield a very famous and a very, very attractive gun to use. So they did a really good job, but the bottom line is they started the war with a bolt action, and with no plans to go. The United States already had the M1 pretty much. Any bugs were pretty much ironed out, and it was just cranking up. It was just a question of money and making it, and that's another reason that we just didn't give the British M1s. We had to equip ourselves with it first. You know, they adopted it in 1936, but you know, it's getting debugged and kind of going through production. And they decided Winchester needed to know how to make them, so they got an educational order. Then they got a larger order later, and you know, manufacturing M1 rifles just to keep up with how the U.S. military was going to expand was huge. And remember, there were plans to put 8 million men and some women, not as many as the percentage you'd see today. But we were going to have, so when I say 8 million man army, I mean, you know, the women, they were going to have in it too. There was going to be an 8 million man army. And, you know, that's why they were cranking those things out. And we did not have any extra M1s for the British. I think we gave them a few Lend-Lease, and but the British weren't going to change caliber. They couldn't in the, you know, it was all too late. Once the war started, hey, it was all too late. You got what you got. And however, though, the SVT, basically having been designed for a rimmed cartridge, 7.62x54R, it would have been a pretty simple conversion to 303 British. And had the British had that about, well, if they'd had the SVT-38, 1938, and developed it, maybe had another year to develop it, they could have put it into production. It could have supplemented the Lee-Enfields. But, you know, the timing was they were going to fight World War II with Lee-Enfields no matter what. So, and the firepower problem that the Lee-Enfield has compared to more modern rifles, the British made up with Sten guns, you know, the same way the Soviets did for the Mosin Nagant. Soviets made PPSH submachine guns and issued them out like crazy. Well, the British issued Stens like crazy. And, you know, the Germans issued MP40s, you know, and, you know, we had the very excellent M1 rifle, but we also had M1 carbines and Thompsons. So, you know, it was just a piece of a puzzle. It wasn't the whole story as to which rifle you used. Okay, this one, next question is, can you mention some of the difficulties you've had in hand loading 3840? That's a 3840 revolver round, which, as we talked at our naming conventions, it is not 38 caliber with 40 grains of black powder. In fact, it is just the other way around. It is a 40 caliber bullet with 38 grains of black powder. And so, therefore, it is exactly backwards of the convention that most black powder cartridges use. So, anyway, 3840 takes a 40 caliber bullet, just the same as a 10 millimeter auto pistol, which is part of the problem. First of all, let me tell you, the gun I've shot it in years ago, I managed to find an orphan 3840 Ruger Blackhawk. It had started life as one of the convertibles with the 10 millimeter cylinder and a 3840 cylinder. By the time I saw it, it was pretty modestly priced because the 10 millimeter cylinder had gone by the wayside somewhere. And for a time, a lot of people were taking those and repurposing them into other things. So it might have been made into a 45 Schofield cylinder for another gun or something. You know, people were taking them and they were using them. Could have even been turned into a 454 Casull for all I know. But people were taking those extra cylinders and repurposing them for whatever reason. And so that may have happened to this gun's 10 millimeter cylinder. I know when I contacted Ruger, they basically said, hey, we've stopped customer or factory support for that model. So, you know, no more cylinders for you. I could go to a custom guy and have a cylinder made. But frankly, I don't have any other 10 millimeter guns, so I've never bothered to do that. 3840, very interesting cartridge. You know, Old West, very cool. The nice part about a 3840, as with a 4440, is you could have a companion Winchester rifle for it. So you had one round for two weapons. Usually, that has one of two results. either your handgun is overpowered or your rifle is underpowered. And in this case, though, it's a pretty good balance because, in a lever gun, you're not going to be doing a lot of long-range shooting anyway. So, maybe out to 100 yards, you got a good gun, you got open sights, and given the kind of accuracy those guns produce at that range, it's not bad. It's not a bad thing at all. So, it's a good little great combination. So, 38-40 is definitely, in the Old West, they never had 45 Colt lever guns. Part of the reason for that has been, it's the speculation has been, well, part of the reason for that is twofold. One, Winchester really didn't like Colt very much, so they didn't want to put 45 Colt on their Winchesters, which may or may not be true. Who cares? And the other reason is it had the 45 Colt had a pretty small rim, so reliable ejection might have been kind of a problem. Although I think the 38-40 and 44-40 kind of share the same rim, so I'm not real sure. Not real sure why they never went with 45 Colt in a in Winchester rifles, but they never did until modern times. Cowboy action shooting basically made that a profitable and desirable thing. So, but anyway, getting back to hand loading, it hand loads like anything else. The only anomaly is if your expander is not set right and you don't A, flare the case enough and expand the inside of the neck enough, you can't crumple a case because they're very thin-walled case. It does have a shoulder, and when you're seating a bullet, if too much downward pressure, if the bullet's not slipping in there, it's all of that force is building up on that shoulder area, and it can collapse it. When that happens, game's over. You've ruined the case. The cases aren't all that expensive, but it is kind of maddening. Same thing can happen with, as we mentioned before, in 577 450 Martini Henry, in which case, you hear cries of anguish and pain because those cases are expensive and very difficult to make. So there's a lot of labor or money going down the drain when you do that. So anyway, that's about the biggest thing. The other thing that's a pain is you have to go find 38-40 revolver bullets, the 40 caliber bullet. Some of the bullets out there are designed for 10 millimeter auto, and that's a problem with all the Lee molds. And I'm a Lee mold guy. I mean, I just am. They're modestly priced, and for the amount of casting I do, they're fine. But their 40 caliber molds are all for 10 millimeter auto. Now they do have a tumble lube one that you could crimp into one of those lube fins they have on the bullet, so you could probably use that. I've never really tried it. That's on my to-do list is to get one of those and try it. But a very 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 fun thing. I use Trail Boss powder. It fills up the case. And again, this is something. It really wouldn't be a As a Ruger Blackhawk, it's really not a. Obviously, doesn't look like a Colt single action with the big sights and the larger frame and all that. But it's a very, very good gun. Very a lot of fun to shoot. Very, very accurate, and well worth it. But it's not one that has a lot of fans or a lot of support out there. There's just not a variety of. It's not like a 45 where you can load anything from 185 up to 270 grains or whatever the. Whatever the deal is. So, you're really going to be kind of stuck with just the available bullets or casting whatever you want, but that's challenging, but it's a fun cartridge. But you can, unlike the straight walled cases, you can ruin some cases by having them buckle under too much pressure if they haven't been expanded enough. Okay, our last question is, does handgun barrel length make a difference in velocity and accuracy? And the answer to that is yes and no. They've done a lot of tests over the years. Every gun magazine would get bored, and they would buy a long-barreled handgun, and then they would get a chronograph thing of how much it was, And then they would cut an inch off down to, you know, 1 inch. And yes, lo and behold, it does. And I think between 4 and 3 inches, it would kind of lose a lot, as I remember these tests. And they also did it with the Dan Wesson pistols, you know, that had that the pistol pack, and they would had the interchangeable barrels and do that. So, yes, velocity and barrel length usually correlate. Now, in different guns, you could have a gun with a very tight barrel and a very gun with a very loose barrel, and, you know, the dimensions, because, you know, they're not always the same. There's tolerances, and so something that's got different tolerances might have, you know, a different result, where you could have maybe a 4-inch barrel is turning out a higher velocity than a 5-inch barrel simply because it's got tighter tolerances. So, you know, you could have some anomalies like that, but generally, the longer the barrel, the more velocity you're going to gain. That's a pretty good rule of thumb to keep. As far as accuracy goes, barrel length does not necessarily guarantee accuracy. Although in a pistol, there's two different types of accuracy. There's intrinsic, which is what you would get in a machine rest, putting it in there. And then there's also practical accuracy, which the longer sight radius on a longer barrel is usually a bit more accurate. You can line up the sights a bit more precisely, and therefore the error is going to be less. And the effect of pulling the trigger, you've got more mass in the gun with a longer barrel. It's going to be heavier, so the gun will move a little less. So practical accuracy speaking, a longer barrel will help, but there's no guarantee that a 8-inch barrel of something is going to outperform a 6-inch barrel in something else. There's just no guarantee, absolute stone-cold guarantee of that. So, but you might be able to shoot the 8-inch barrel better because the sights are farther apart, you're aligning them a little more precisely, and the heavy weight of the gun with the extra barrel length, it moves a little bit less when the trigger's being pulled. So, that's basically the take on it. I have never really seen a 2-inch barrel shoot great at any distance. Snub nose, they're made for up close and personal. They excel at it. So if you take a snub nose and a good 6-inch barrel revolver, I think you can the differences in barrel length will be illustrated to you. And another variable is, of course, how good are the sights. Target style sights are going to help practical accuracy because you can see them better, they're more precise, you can align them better. The kind of the trough or hog wallow sights that are just down the center of a frame on, you know, many fixed-sighted guns are not going to be as easy to see or as precise. So anyway, that's it. Well, I hope you enjoyed this edition of Old School Guns. Remember, hit the follower button, hit the subscription button, hit the like button, hit something if you like what you heard and would like to hear some more. And when you do that, you'll get a notification as to when the next episode is posted. But for right now, this is Old School Guns, out.